Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in snowy and cold Seattle, Washington. We're here today with Dennis Wagner, Executive Director of Access Research Network, and Kevin Wirth, Director of Media Relations for the Access Research Network, who are both going to discuss with us the Access Research Network's top 10 intelligent design news stories for the year of 2008. The Access Research Network, also known as ARN, is actually one of the oldest intelligent design organizations. It got its start as a student-focused group at the University of California at Santa Barbara back in the early 1980s and late 1970s called Students for Origins Research. And over the years, they evolved into a group that deals specifically with intelligent design. And really, their website, ARN.org, is, in my opinion, the most extensive and thorough online website where you can buy intelligent design resources like videos and books and other things. So if you're looking for intelligent design Christmas presents, ARN is probably one of the best places for you to go. One of the other services that ARN provides, aside from their blog and online archive of articles, is a top 10 news stories for intelligent design and evolution every year. And so we have Dennis Wagner and Kevin Wirth on the phone with us today to talk about ARN's top 10 science news stories for 2008. So Dennis and Kevin, thanks for being on the show with us.
You're welcome, Casey.
Thanks for inviting us.
Well, I just wanted to say to your listeners, Casey, that these top 10 stories can be found on our website. So if they hear one they're interested in, they can go look it up at arn.org/top10. That's T-O-P and then 10. So these are available as PDF downloads, and they also have links to some of the science stories that we're reporting on here. So they can go look at the original science journals that these stories are reported in.
Well, that's excellent, Dennis. And before we jump into those top 10 stories, just recently, the journal Science actually released its top 10 scientific breakthroughs for the year of 2008. And interestingly, not a single one of its breakthroughs deals with evolutionary biology. Is that surprising to you guys at all?
I think the fact that we don't have any exciting new news about evolution is news in itself. And our stories, that, as you'll see as we get into it, we call it the top 10 Darwin and design stories because we think these are stories that shed light on either side. Have we learned anything new about Darwinian evolution that would make us think that it's true or not true, or where the boundary is of what it can actually do, and then have we learned anything new about evidence for design in nature? So I guess it doesn't surprise me based on some of the stories that we're going to report on, because most of them tell us about the failures of Darwinian evolution to explain life, not on new things that it's explaining.
I think this is probably the most exciting and revealing area of research that will probably prove to be a major consternation point for Darwinians and evolutionists in the near future.
Well, and I think that as you guys go down the list of your top 10 stories, especially as you get to your number one story, our listeners are going to understand exactly why evolutionary biology was not producing new breakthroughs in the year 2008. One last point before we jump into this. The top scientific breakthrough reported by the journal Science was actually a technique that scientists have discovered to, as they say, reprogram cells in order to convert them into stem cells that can be used to treat diseases. And of course, the title of their article was actually, quote, reprogramming cells, unquote. Their article actually admits the researchers have not yet mastered how to reprogram cells into stem cells. So the very fact that cells are essentially running on software, which can reprogram the cellular hardware, to me points to an intelligent design of life. You would not expect those kinds of features to arise via blind and unguided processes.
You're exactly right, Casey. You can't reprogram something unless it's been programmed in the first place. And so that raises the question, can random processes program anything? And it's the same thing with some of the stories we'll talk about today. Biologists and scientists are reverse engineering things in nature. How can you reverse engineer something that wasn't engineered in the first place? So I think both of those are pointing to signs of intelligence or engineering that was evident from the beginning.
What were your top 10 Darwin design news stories for 2008?
Well, Casey, we're going to start with with a couple honorable mentions, and I'll just tell you a little bit about the process. We had all of our reporters, not only for ARN, but other organizations that work in this news area, submit their top stories for the year. And we compiled the list. We had 20 or 30 stories, and so we kind of filtered through those, wrote up summaries of them, and we sent them back out to this same group to vote on what they thought were the top 10. And it was really tough. The top five stories that we'll hear about had pretty strong votes, so we think those pretty strongly belong in the top five. But after that, there's another five or 10 stories that were all pretty close. And so I wanted to start with the honorable mention stories that didn't make the top 10, but they still got a lot of votes. And I think that it proves our point here about which direction some of this science is headed. One is the rise of the non-material neuroscience movement. This is basically the debate that's going on about the connection or link between our brain and our mind. The reductionists, the materialists, want to say that the mind is somehow just a manifestation of the brain, some neurochemical thing that, you know, our brain does the sensing and then our mind forms the thoughts about that. And the materialists would say that they're very directly linked in some reductionist way. But more and more research is coming out now, empirical research, that shows that that's not the case, that there's kind of a dualism that exists. And in fact, in many cases, the research of Jeffrey Schwartz and others has shown that the mind can actually control the brain, so the other way around that was sometimes thought by the reductionists. So that's really interesting. And there's an article in New Scientist, the October 22nd issue, that reports on this with great alarm, that these non-material neuroscientists are kind of growing in this whole area. There's an article about a two-stroke machine that was discovered in the cell. There's this large protein shaped somewhat like a barrel with a lid on it, and just recently they discovered that that's not just an empty cavity, but inside there was a system, a protein biochemical system that acts as a two-stroke engine to move parts of the cell in and out, and there's two timers associated with this two-stroke engine. Another one was that junk DNA proves to be functional. This story keeps coming up every year that because the evolutionary theory kind of predicts that there would be some leftover things in our DNA from millions of years of evolution. There would be some parts that were discarded, not needed. And every year they keep finding more and more purposes that parts of this junk DNA act as regulating genes or provide binding sites for RNA transcription machines. And so I like to call this the Darwin God of the Gaps, because the Darwinists had always had these sections of the DNA that they didn't understand, they didn't know what it did, so they called it junk DNA, and it must be left over from evolution. But we're beginning to close those gaps with more understanding now as we learn more and more about the functions of DNA. Two last ones on the honorable mention. One was Paley's watch found in bacteria. As you know, Paley, a couple hundred years ago, had the argument for design that if you were walking through the forest and found a watch, you would know that it was designed by somebody because it had the hallmarks of design on it. And philosophers kind of discarded the idea of saying, well, that's fine for a machine, but life's not a machine. Well, there may be more relation there between life and machines as we begin looking at this and design nature of machines, as they've found proteins that have moving parts of a clock. There's actually cogs and gears and mechanisms, and it keeps a 24-hour cycle, ratchets that move to keep accurate time. I think Paley would be jumping up and down if he had a chance to read this article in Science Magazine on October 31st issue that kind of reviews all the research that's gone into that area. And the final honorable mention story is Darwin's Tree of Life. It's one of the icons of evolution, that everything started at one point, life branched out through evolutionary process. And every year we get more and more conflicting data when you compare the molecular evidence with the body plan evidence, and you get conflicting stories on what that tree might have looked like. And I think that kind of came to a head this year when in the February issue of Cladistics magazine, there was an article entitled The Unfalsifiability of Cladograms and Its Consequences. And the author there, I love his concluding statement. He says, "Seeking phylogenetic trees does not represent a scientific endeavor, and cladograms represent no scientific but metaphysical hypothesis." In other words, it's kind of this circular reasoning that's going on.
Thanks, Dennis. So I understand, Kevin Wirth, you're going to start us with the top 10 countdown.
Number 10 on our top 10 list was the design-based biomimetics issue, where, you know, we're seeing some tangible results here. Biomimetic research is based on the premise that the natural world is information rich and that reverse engineering methodologies are likely to be fruitful. There were a couple of significant articles in the February 22, 2008 issue of Science that discuss how the natural world does not just provide examples of materials that are interesting to scientists and engineers, but they actually demonstrate mechanical design principles. And then there was another article on July 8th in Science Daily that reported on how engineers are turning to marine biology for insight into how to build better turbine blades and wings. They said, in part, the shape of whale flippers with one bumpy edge has inspired the creation of a completely novel design for wind turbine blades. This design has been shown to be more efficient and also quieter, but defies traditional engineering theories. So apparently, small bumps on the leading edge of the flippers create vortices as the whale moves through the water. This uneven flow helps to generate more lift without the occurrence of stall, as well as enhancing the maneuverability and agility of the whale.
I think that the practice of biomimetics by engineers is increasingly pointing to intelligent design having its role in the origin of various structures in life. I think we're just going to see more and more of this in the future.
Our number 9 story for 2008 was titled, Have Cosmologists Lost Their Brains? And this is an interesting article that appeared in the January 15th issue of New York Times. Dennis Overby there reported this rather shocking article about the latest ideas that cosmologists are bouncing around, naked brains floating in space, universes bubbling off in all directions all the time, universes that make observers in a snap, universes that disappear, quantum fluxion leaps that cause a big bang that would destroy us in a flash, all these kind of ideas. And this guy was saying none of these ideas have any basis in reality, nothing that has been observed, and this is getting kind of away from the traditional science that we're used to. We're seeing a lot of this in response from the materialists who, you know, can't deal with a designed universe or the implications of a finely tuned universe, and so they come up with the idea, well, there must have been multiple universes or billions of universes, and so we see the materialists kind of resorting to things that can't be observed or even proven to try to get away from the implications of ideas of design.
Our number 8 top story of 2008 was about how leading biologists are marveling at the irreducible complexity of the ribosome. In January 2008, the transcripts of the meeting titled Life, What a Concept, held at Eastover Farm in Bethlehem, Connecticut, the previous summer, were finally released. Craig Venter, a leader in genomics at the Human Genome Project, stated that we talked about the ribosome, we tried to make synthetic ribosomes, starting with the genetic code and building them. The ribosome is such an irreducibly beautiful, complex entity. You can make synthetic ribosomes, but they don't function totally yet. Nobody knows how to get the ones that can actually do protein synthesis. I think that's pretty revealing admission, and right in line with what ID advocates say we should be looking at. George Church, who's the director of the Center for Computational Genetics, also marveled at the complexity of the ribosome. He said, the ribosome, both looking at the past and at the future, is a very significant structure. It's the most complicated thing that is present in all organisms. He ends his comment by saying, and if I were to be an intelligent design defender, I would focus on this. How did the ribosome come to be? The origin and development of the ribosome will continue to be a hot topic in the coming years as researchers continue to plumb the depths of what makes the components of the cell work. I'm predicting they will continue to be confronted with the increasingly vexing problem of explaining how evolutionary mechanisms can fully account for them. I think the handwriting's already on the wall for Darwinians, and I think we're going to be reaching critical mass on this topic sometime soon.
I personally would love to see more ID proponents take up the ribosome as a research topic in the future.
Our number 7 story, Casey, illustrates that academic freedom over origins is not just a U.S. issue. Sometimes I think the media paints it that way, saying, oh, it's just those fundamentalists in the U.S. that are hung up over Darwin. But we had an example last year, just a couple months ago, where the director of education was asked to step down at the Royal Society because he had expressed an openness in discussing various philosophies of teaching how we got here. We're talking about Professor Michael Rice. He trains educators, so he spent quite a lot of time studying this issue, and he actually published a paper about the same time that he gave a talk on this issue. And basically what he was saying is there's different world views. There's different ways to look at the interactions between science and religion, and he goes through the idea that a lot of scientists promote that science and religion are two different domains, and they don't overlap, and one has to tell you about the natural world and one about the spiritual world, but that's only only one way to look at things. That was popular with Stephen Gould and others. There's also different worldviews that look at how those overlap and how religion informs science and science informs religion. So there's different ways of structuring that, and Rice was a proponent of teaching those different ways because he said when kids come in to our schools, they come from these different worldviews, and we need to value their worldviews. Even though he didn't agree with any creationist ideas, he's a proponent of your standard evolutionary theories, but he felt as an educator it was the right thing to do to say, okay, there's different ways of looking at our world and the role that religion and science play in it. And so for that openness and exploring ideas, three Nobel laureates in Britain called for his head, basically. And one of them said, there's no way that an ordained minister, which Michael Rice is, for whom unverified dogma must represent a major, if not the major, pillar in their lives, can present free-thinking, doubt-based scientific philosophy honestly or disinterestedly. Basically, he's making the accusation that anybody that has religious beliefs must be dogmatic and can't be a free-thinking person. And I just find that a very ironic statement because it's obvious that the guy making this has his own dogma that he's protecting. That's the dogma of Darwinism and kind of the reductionist thinking. In a free society, we really want all ideas to be able to be compared and held up to the light and made best evidence win. But it's obvious in Britain that that's not the case, and it's much like it is here in the U.S. And if you dare look at competing ideas, you lose your job. And he's a good example of that.
And Dennis, Michael Rice was a Darwinist. I mean, he's not even a real Darwin skeptic. He's just basically suggesting that we not treat Darwin skeptics as if they are scum of the earth. And for that,
right. He
gets fired.
And because he had a religious degree, they assumed that he had religious motives in making that statement.
Let's go on to top story number six, which is all about finding a molecular clutch in the flagella. You know, the rotary motor in the E. coli bacteria has long been the poster child of intelligent design theorists. The case for design with regard to that engine became even more compelling in 2008, as scientists reported in the June 20th issue of Science. They've now discovered a nanotechnology clutch that disengages the bacterium flagellum's tail from the engine and that powers its rotation. The clutch solution is a rather neat, effective, and potentially reversible mechanism. Researchers have identified a gene responsible for making the EPSE protein, which engages with the critical protein transmitting torque to the flagellum and removing the link to the source of power. The measure of complexity is in the unique shape of the EPSE protein and its ability to engage with the torque-transmitting protein so that power is no longer transmitted. The research team is now looking for a protein that disengages the clutch and reconnects the motor. So what this means is that not only do we find that the flagellum is driven by a motor, but now we've also found that it can function on cruise control, which is pretty exciting.
Well, Casey, the number five story is one that you're familiar with. I know you did a podcast on this already this year, and that's the Biologic Institute, which is the institute affiliated with Discovery Institute and where we have some scientists doing some research from an intelligent design perspective. They've released a software program called Stylus, which is a system for evolutionary experimentation. We thought that this was an exciting event, one, because it is an intelligent design lab where this is coming out of, and this was published in a peer-review paper in PLOS One journal. It really, I think, takes the simulations of evolution that have existed to the next level, and they've done it in a format that can be shared. Their code has been posted at sourceforge.net, and anybody can download this code and run it on Unix machines. It's very easy to build your sample inputs in text files and submit it and see graphical outputs from it, which is a big step up from some of the previous tools that just dump some data out that you had a hard time understanding. In biological systems, we have levels of functionality and complexity. We have the genes and the proteins and the cells and all these different nested hierarchies. So I think this is a very exciting in that it, you know, this is a tool that the authors say they didn't try to design this thing to prove evolution or disprove evolution. They tried to design it to reflect more closely what life actually does when it goes through changes. And so this is a great new tool that I think will help scientists everywhere because it's being shared as freeware to experiment with this. And I would encourage anyone that has an interest in this to go to their website, either at Biologic or at the sourceforge.net, and download the software and play with it.
The Stylus program is really trying to beat out, I would say, some of the more advanced programs such as Aveda, which fall very short of accurately modeling the evolutionary process. And I think Stylus is really the next evolution, so to speak, in terms of trying to accurately model with computers how evolution takes place. And if they can do this, we might really be able to get a grasp of exactly what kind of new information evolutionary processes can produce. So thanks for covering this, Dennis. This is very exciting research. Kevin, do you have the next one for us?
Casey, it's all about the Louisiana Academic Freedom Act. Just a couple months after Expelled hit the theaters, the Louisiana State Senate passed a landmark academic freedom bill by a 36-0 vote, where, you know, it protects teachers who want to encourage critical thinking and objective discussion about evolution and other scientific topics. Known as the Louisiana Science Education Act, the bill was previously passed by the state's House of Representatives with, I think it was 94-3 vote. And similar bills were considered earlier this year in six states as part of their academic freedom legislation designed to protect teachers who teach both the scientific strengths and weaknesses of evolutionary theory. This is a significant effort tied to protecting academic freedom and freedom of speech, I think. And I don't mind saying here, as you know, that with the publication of Slaughter of the Dissidents, which we'll be talking about later, we now have even more insight into just how important these freedoms are and why bills like this are really needed.
Well, I really appreciate you mentioning this, Kevin, and also the work that you've done to help promote awareness about the persecution that scientists and educators are experiencing if they doubt Darwin. And I think you made a good point, and that is that a lot of this academic freedom legislation this year was probably very much inspired by the raising of the public's consciousness that took place as a result of Expelled. Expelled is having a real impact upon our nation in that it truly is starting a nationwide dialogue about the importance of academic freedom to dissent from Darwinism. And I anticipate we're going to see more of these academic freedom bills in the future as well, and hopefully Louisiana will not be the last one to actually become passed into law. So thank you for mentioning this, Kevin. Dennis, what do you have for us next?
Well, you just led right into it, Casey, and that's our number three story, which was the Expelled movie. As far as a cultural event, it was one of the largest events, I think, in our country, as it was released in over 1,000 theaters in April, and it quickly climbed to the number one political documentary of 2008. I think it did somewhere over $7 million in the U.S., which is not a lot compared to action movies. But for a documentary, that was great, and it put it on the number 12 position for all time for documentary movies. I think for us that have been following this issue for a long time, it was really neat to see this go public in a way. And as I talked to people who saw the movie and didn't really have a background in the whole Darwin or design debate, I was getting comments from them like it was a very disturbing movie. And I think they came away thinking, that doesn't really happen in the United States. We're free here to express our thoughts and our ideas. And just the thought that people would lose their jobs, that journalists would be threatened because they dare challenge the evolutionary worldview, people were just dumbfounded to see that. The film didn't focus just on those who have challenged Darwinism, but it also gave us a view into some of those that are promoting Darwinism in our schools. It became pretty clear to me that the guys that are trying to protect Darwinism are the dogmatists, and they come across as very protective of their ideas and not wanting it to be challenged in any way. And yet you look at the intelligent design people that were interviewed, Paul Nelson and Steve Myers and others, and Guillermo Gonzalez, and you said, these guys are really calm, cool heads. I can't understand why their ideas are not being allowed in the classrooms. I think this movie was one of the most significant events in the last 20 years that I've been following this, as far as making the public aware of this kind of limit on the academic freedom and freedom of speech that goes on in our schools and our culture in general around this whole issue of where we came from. There's also, in case you want to mention a couple of websites related to this movie, we have one at ARN called arn.org/expelled, where we have articles and background information on a lot of the people that were featured in this movie. You can buy copies of the DVD there. We've got a super bundle that includes that and the Slaughter of the Dissident book and some other videos. So that's a great resource page for people that want to know more about this movie. And also, in response to this movie, there's been over 17,000 people have signed the Academic Freedom Petition. There's a website for that, academicfreedompetition.com. And they have a statement there that you can go look at. And if you agree with that statement that we should have academic freedom to explore these issues, go ahead and sign that.
And another thing some of the critics are saying is the examples used in the movie Expelled for Caroline Crocker and a lot of the other folks that are mentioned are just that. They're just a couple of examples that this practice of discrimination and persecution is not widespread. But as you know, in the book Slaughter of the Dissidents, we actually provide a plethora of examples of this kind of treatment, and we make the case that it's not just a onesie-twosie kind of thing, but that it is widespread, and it happens quite frequently.
Well, and if it wasn't so widespread, I literally wouldn't have a job, because part of my job at Discovery Institute is to help support scientists and educators and students who are experiencing this persecution. So you make a very good point there, Kevin. Who's got the next top story for us here?
Yeah, that would be me, Casey. We're going to talk about how some unlikely partners, atheists and agnostics, are coming to the defense of ID. Darwin and design public debates took an interesting turn in 2008 as atheists and agnostics took up the torch for ID and theologians went to bat for Darwin. This surprising development and role reversal was probably most evident at a November 7th debate in Texas, where agnostic Dr. David Berlinski is a well-known skeptic of Darwinism, and Dr. Bradley Montan, an atheist philosopher of physics, they both defended intelligent design, while British theologian Dr. Dennis Alexander and well-known atheist and physicist Dr. Lawrence Krauss defended evolution. Montan explains why intelligent design deserves a place at the table in the scientific debate, despite the extreme pressure to the contrary from his Darwinist peers. And, another example of this trend was agnostic philosopher and sociologist Steve Fuller's defense of ID in his newest book called Dissent Over Descent, and the ensuing public debate about his book in the online pages of The New Humanist. Meanwhile, there's one other gentleman I'd like to mention, self-declared atheist and philosopher and New York University law professor, Thomas Nagel. He wrote an article titled Public Education and Intelligent Design, where he defends the constitutionality of teaching ID and suggests that ID is a credible approach to this issue on many different levels. So I was encouraged to see that.
But if you notice, in most of these cases, these are tenured professors. guys that don't have tenure wouldn't be able to speak up like this. And even those that are tenured and speak out receive incredible pressure from their peers. I remember, Casey, that Professor Montan in his podcast with you talked about how shocked he was at the treatment that he got from the Darwinist when he came to bat for ID. And he was almost ashamed of their behavior.
You know, these atheists who are standing up and, you know, being honest about their views, that they think that ID is a viable scientific theory, they really are risking quite a bit in their careers. So we really need to stand with them and their right to have academic freedom to state their views.
And Casey, that brings us to the number one story in our countdown for 2008. Do you have a drum roll or anything you can do for us?
I have the beat of the flagellum is what I have.
Okay, the beat of the flagellum. There you go. The number one story is entitled The Altenburg 16, the name that a freelance reporter, Susan Mazur, gave to a group of biologists, philosophers, that got together in Altenburg, Austria this past year and wanted to look for a new theory of evolution because they feel Darwinism is dead. And what is so shocking about this story is this isn't the creationists, this isn't the intelligent design people. These are the leading thinkers about biology and evolution, and they basically say that evolution as practiced by biologists today and taught in a classroom is inadequate to accommodate other new phenomena. A lot of these guys are proponents of an idea called self-organization. In other words, they say, okay, we now all agree that random mutations and natural selection can't possibly explain for the life that we see. There must be something else. And so these guys say, well, we know that there's physical properties in the world that allow snowflakes to form under certain conditions, and they have some symmetry to them, and they look like they're kind of designed. So based on that, there must be something in the chemical and biological world that has a similar nature. They have no idea what that thing is, not being able to document that, but kind of like the cosmologist, you know, when faced with the evidence of design and the lack of evidence for a random explanation of the universe, they're forced to find something else. They don't know where else to go. Going to intelligent design is just repugnant to them, and so they are getting together and seeing if they can come up with another theory of evolution because they realize that Darwin's ideas, after all these years, don't explain everything. This freelance reporter in there's an online magazine called Scoop. In March, she first broke this story. I would say if you just read one thing this year, on the Darwin and Design debate, read her article, her March 4th article, or read her ebook. And I think it will really open your eyes to the fact that the case against Darwinism is not some conspiracy theory of the ideas. This is mainstream scientists are now acknowledging that Darwinism is dead as a theory of evolution. But again, Casey, I just want to say it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun to put together these top 10 stories, and your readers, listeners can find them on our website at arn.org/top10, T-O-P-1-0.
Well, Dennis Wagner and Kevin Wirth, it's been a lot of fun talking to you guys about these top stories. Again, our listeners, you can go to the website arn.org/top10, and the 10 is just the number 10, so arn.org/top10 to see the Access Research Network's top Darwin and Design stories for the year of 2008. Thank you very much, Dennis and Kevin, for being on the show and taking the time to explain to us today about your top 10 news stories for this year.
Thank you, Casey.
Thanks, Casey.
This is Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast. Stay tuned. We're going to have another interview real soon with Dennis Wagner and Kevin Wirth about the top 10 intelligent design and evolution resources for the year of 2008. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.